From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The New York chokehold decision. Protesters take to the streets.
Anybody with eyes can see what happened. How in the hell did it go that way?
Ferguson fallout. St. Louis Rams football players raise their hands in protest. Here's tight end Jared Cook.
It's not just about Ferguson. It's a message worldwide that for young adults and for everybody that you can protest and you can do things peacefully without getting out of line.
North Korea and Sony Pictures. Was it payback for an upcoming comedy about assassinating the Supreme Leader?
You want to go kill Kim Jong-un?
Totally. I'd love to assassinate Kim Jong-un. It's a date.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ron Allen of NBC News, Josh Letterman of the Associated Press, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us, listeners, on air or online. What do you make of the grand jury's decision in New York? What's moving you and the world this week? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be joined in just a couple of minutes by Ron Allen of NBC News. Here's from Washington, Josh Letterman, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Josh, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane. Hello, Josh.
We'll begin with the protests in New York and across the country after the grand jury decision there not to indict the police officer in the death of Eric Garner. Here's the widow of Eric Garner saying she is determined to seek justice for her husband.
A cop did wrong. Somebody that get paid to do right did wrong, and he's not held accountable for it. But my husband's death will not be in vain. As long as I have a breath in my body, I will fight the fight to the end.
Here's another protester angered and concerned by the grand jury decision not to indict the police officer who was involved. Garner's stepfather tried to calm him down. Here's that.
I was right there. I was right there. I was there, Mr. Garner. Okay. Every step of the way.
Right,
I have pictures, everything.
Come on in.
I was doing everything peacefully, but it's gotten to the point where
you gotta keep the peace.
It's wrong.
I know.
We all are hurt.
It's like, where are we headed for? What's the future for me? What's the future for me? You know what I'm saying? For my child, for my son. What is his future?
Jack Beatty, start us off here. What do you make of these protests in New York and across the country?
Well, Jane, the cover of this week's New Yorker speaks to this. It shows the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, half of it white, half of it black, and not meeting in the middle. And that view of a similar symbol and an iconic New York background could be drawn this week. And certainly that speaks to something in the air. It speaks to the recent poll of 1,000 adults just a month ago that showed while 62% of African Americans believe that Officer Wilson was at fault in the shooting of Mr. Brown in Ferguson, only 22% of whites took that position. And you've seen the racial divide in the conduct, I think, of these grand jurors in Staten Island, the white grand jurors who must have voted not to indict the New York officer. And you see it in above all, you see it in the fear that the black community has that even when they're menaced by the criminal elements, they can't call on the police. That is one side of the story. There's another side, though, and I saw it in the protesters in Boston, the glimpses on the media in Boston and New York, Chicago, Atlanta, Washington. They were an integrated crowd. These were young white and black people out protesting who were saying it ends now. And I have to think that in this whole you know, tragic miasma, this is an encouraging sign that the indignation at this injustice is much wider than the black community. And those two prongs, arms of the Gateway Arch on the New Yorker cover, those two are coming closer together in outrage at this habitual, inveterate practice of police toward African Americans.
Here's some audio Wednesday in Washington, President Obama vowing his effort to solve the problem of racial tensions that exist between law enforcement and minorities in communities nationwide.
We recognize this is an American problem and not just a black problem or a brown problem or a Native American problem. This is an American problem. When anybody in this country is not being treated equally under the law, that's a problem. And it's my job as president to help solve it.
Josh Letterman, how's the president responded to this crisis in New York and, of course, in Ferguson?
I think this has been pretty difficult for the president, in some ways even more difficult than the Trayvon Martin situation that he was dealing with a number of months ago. The president has really tried to strike a careful balance between channeling the very legitimate and real concerns and feelings that people have about this in communities around the country, and not trying to make this an attack on law enforcement, not trying to issue any kind of blanket condemnations or to prejudge situations at the same time that the federal government is conducting its own investigation. The president, his message has kind of evolved on this as he's tried to find a way to, instead of making this about one individual verdict, instead try and make it a conversation about how do we bring law enforcement and police closer together in the future, how do we deal with these on a national level, bringing in civil rights activists to the White House, law enforcement leaders, and trying to find a constructive way to talk about it. But as we've seen, that continues to be a challenge, particularly as we have new cases coming up, this latest incident in Staten Island, and of course some concerns about the police situation in Cleveland as well. It starts to mushroom, and it's become very difficult for the president to address.
I believe we have Ron Allen now, NBC News correspondent. Ron, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Well, thank you for being here. We don't know as much about the grand jury as we did in the Ferguson case, but you've been in the middle of both of these stories. Give us your perspective. Tell us about the decision in the Eric Garner case first.
Well, I think most people are more shocked by that decision than the Michael Brown decision because of the videotape and because of what people see and because they're able to make a much clearer decision, they think, about what they saw than in the other case. And what you see does not seem to be right. It seems like something is going wrong there, and it seems to many people that a crime is being committed because a man dies and because you have a number of police officers surrounding him, pushing him on the ground, and you can hear him saying, "I can't breathe," although the response to that from many is that if he can't breathe, he wouldn't have been able to speak. But be that as it may, I think the reaction to the Garner grand jury decision is in some ways much more of shock, I guess you could say. In Ferguson, I don't think anybody expected the grand jury to indict Officer Darren Wilson, mainly because grand juries don't tend to indict white police officers for killing young black men in the country anywhere. But in that case, I think there was just a feeling that of more just pessimism about it. And the facts in that case would seem to suggest that Michael Brown certainly didn't deserve to die, as no one does, but that he didn't comply with what the police were telling him to do. There was some sort of altercation. The police insisted, of course, that he started it. But there's a time in that situation where Michael Brown is away from the officer, where he runs away, separates himself from the car, and I think most people looking at that say, okay, in that moment now, shouldn't the officer have made a different set of decisions that perhaps could have prevented this being a deadly encounter? The officer, the prosecutor, they insist, of course, that this was a life and death situation. It took 90 seconds, and the officer was in fear for his life. The big problem in that situation, of course, is that we only hear one side of the story, as in both of these. We only hear the officer's side of the story, and panoply of witnesses who give conflicting accounts, as witnesses always do. But I think that the tragedy in both of these situations, of course, is that two young men are dead, and people feel very, very strongly that there should have been a different outcome.
Here's a press conference yesterday in New York City. Mayor Bill de Blasio announcing the start of a retraining of New York City police officers. He said that the relationship between police and the community has to change.
People need to know that black lives and brown lives matter as much as white lives.
Ron Allen, the police union in New York is not at all happy about the mayor's response. Tell us why.
I think the word betray has been used. And
yes, being thrown under the bus, I think, is the other phrase. Yes.
Yes, very strong language, because he is the leader of the city. But, of course, Mayor de Blasio is from a mixed-race family, and he has a son who is black, at least identifies as such and looks as such, and the reality on the streets is that young black men in New York and elsewhere feel like they are not treated fairly. They feel threatened. And, you know, in this situation, perception is reality. You know, one of the problems with this whole big issue is that there are no police departments are not required to report officer-involved shootings and the suspects by race at all. So we don't know what the facts are overall, because it's an incomplete picture. But certainly the perception and the data that are out there suggest that that these encounters happen a lot. The police, of course, say crime happens in these communities of color more often in a disproportionate way, which is also true. But I think the police in New York and elsewhere feel, and I talked to a lot of police officers in St. Louis and Ferguson, they feel like they're getting a bad rap. They're feeling like they're dealing with a lot of societal problems, unemployment, poverty, lack of respect for authority, and they are left to deal with these issues on the streets on a day-to-day basis in real time in very stressful emotional situations. And, you know, certainly police officers want to go home at the end of the day, too, and they certainly have a very, very difficult job. And that's why they feel that Mayor de Blasio and others should be standing up out in St. Louis. There was a very, very angry response when the St. Louis Rams players took the field with a hands-up, don't shoot posture. The unions were outraged by that more so than arguably the hundreds of other people who have been doing the same thing around the country.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a big week in the news, and you can join the conversation. What do you make of Iran carrying out airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq? The 17 states filing lawsuits against the president's executive action on immigration. Great panel this hour. Josh Letterman of the Associated Press, Ron Allen of NBC News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Lots of listeners want to get in here. Let's hear from some. Kane is first in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Kane. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
My comment was just, I'm somebody who, like, in the Darren Wilson case in particular, like, I was really disconcerted that the black community, regardless of, like, not seeing any evidence and even the evidence to the contrary coming out, that they were still calling for the indictment of Darren Wilson. I was really disconcerting to me that they were going to hold one man's life accountable for the larger problems of society. But having said that, I'm even more disconcerted that this grand jury in Staten Island didn't indict this guy. I mean, I think it does a real disservice to the outcome of the other case that they didn't indict this guy, and that's basically my comment.
Kane, thank you. Here's Michael in Watertown with his thoughts. Michael, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Brown is not Medgar Evers or Emmett Till. I mean, he went into a store with a hard-working immigrant and grabbed him by the throat and stole his merchandise. It's called strong-arm robbery. Now, I don't know what kind of moral relativism is going on, but if a police officer says, get out of the road, and you say, no, leave off, and you go and punch him in the face and reach his revolver, I mean, is this what the NAACP wants to take as a case to argue for the impoverishment of their community?
Michael, thank you. Let's go to Mark in Acton for another perspective. Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I think to some extent we're being disturbed by the focus, the reporting on this, which tends to focus on the guilt or innocence of the police officer, and that's not what's at issue here. The question is not whether the officer is guilty or innocent. The question is whether a trial even should take place, and that's what's really outrageous here. And the problem, I think, is that you have local prosecutors who are familiar with these police officers, have to work with them every day. They're presenting the case of the grand jury. What happened in the grand jury in Missouri was extraordinary. That's not the way grand juries work.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutor did everything possible to ensure that no indictment came down. And I think that we need a solution to this. And the solution may be that whenever you have a police officer or other employee of the state involved in taking a life, that you need an appointment of a special prosecutor to present to a grand jury.
So you're saying the grand jury system may be broken, Mark. Thank you. Ron Allen, let me get you in on that. This is not about guilt or innocence of an officer. This is about a grand jury system that needs to be fixed. What do you say to that, Ron?
Well, the caller's right. The grand jury process in Ferguson and in New York didn't operate as a grand jury normally does. In most grand jury situations, a prosecutor walks in and says, here's the charge I want, and here's several pieces of evidence, and walks out later with what he wants. You know, the old cliche, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. It's like a 99% or whatever success rate for prosecutors. Mm-hmm. In both of these situations, they said, well, here, grand jurors, I'm going to show you everything, or at least, and you decide. And so, yes, a lot of people are saying that the prosecutors would argue, well, we were trying to be open and fair and transparent. But the critics would say, well, you have these grand jurors who heard the thing happen the other way for weeks and weeks and weeks. And now they hear this differently. It distorts the system. And I've heard a lot of people say that in a case involving an officer involved shooting, that, yes, a special prosecutor not from that same county should, in fact, look at these facts. And there are bills in the Missouri legislature, I know, that are in process trying to make that the law. Mm-hmm. So that, yes, there's a more independent arbiter deciding these things, and maybe going forward, that might be one solution that comes about.
Let's go to Bill in Wheatfield, New York. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, a quick comment. I just think the news and even one of your guests has it wrong.
Okay.
About in the New York grand jury. Yeah, I'm appalled of the way that came out, but I don't think that one should be brought up as a racial thing. I think that policeman, if it would have been a white guy down on the ground, handcuffed, he would have been choking him too. That one to me is not a racial thing.
All right, Bill. Danielle is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Danielle, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick point. So I'm an immigrant with black skin. I happen to be married to a white guy with blonde hair, blue eyes. We have a son together. And I guess this made me pause and made me really worried about my son's future. So I wrote a quick letter to the editor and I expressed this concern. And what was shocking to me was here in Boston, the comments that letter received. I was told I should go back to where I came from. I was told that it's my fault because I'm a bad parent. That's why my son will end up in this situation. That if I train my son to be respectful, this will never happen.
Mm.
Whereas my father, who is a 6'2", black man with a PhD in French, who speaks fluent French and fluent Spanish as a professor, one day happened to get upset with the chair of his department, and the chair called the police.
Hmm.
So my father, who never had any criminal record, came face to face with the policeman, and thank goodness my father just de-escalated immediately so the policeman could see that there's nothing happening here, and he left.
So many stories coming out, Danielle. I appreciate you calling. Ron Allen, wrap us up here a bit with the federal civil rights investigation. Do you see that coming here?
Well, there are two in Ferguson of the police department and of the case, and the indications are that it's unlikely that they will press civil rights charges against Darren Wilson, and likely that they are going to try to overhaul the police department. Here in New York, they've announced a civil rights investigation as well, and it's perhaps again, in this case in New York, there's videotape, which perhaps makes a civil rights violation charge more likely. But generally speaking, these civil rights cases don't produce what people want them to. You know, Rodney King back in the 90s is a big exception, of course. But generally, people want this federal government to step in, and the result, I believe, tends to be more often that reforms come through to these departments and pressure to change hiring, training, those kinds of practices, but the individual cases are not resolved differently at the federal level. It's just a higher standard, although it sounds like a lower standard, civil rights violation. It's a tougher legal standard to prove. So that's where that stands going forward.
Well, let's switch gears here just a bit. To the Pentagon this week, confirming that Iranian jets carried out airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Iraq this week. We've known that Iranian troops have been fighting alongside Iraqi forces, but this is the first we've heard of Iranian air activity. On Wednesday at NATO headquarters in Brussels, Secretary of State John Kerry said these airstrikes by Iran on Islamic militants wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing.
That's not something that we're coordinating. The Iraqis have the overall responsibility for their own ground and air operations, and what they choose to do is up to them.
Jack Beatty, strange alliances here. What do you make of it?
Yes, we're allies of a kind, aren't we?
Yes.
You know, and this really throws up the throws light on the complexity of the whole Obama policy in that area. I mean, throughout the past several years, I think the president has had his eye on the main ball, which is avoiding war with Iran. We are on course for war with Iran unless we can reach an agreement on nukes with them. The president has said they will not get a weapon and they will not be contained. Well, that doesn't leave any other option. That would be a catastrophe on so many fronts, it isn't even worth considering. I mean, the war games, for example, on this have shown it would result in perhaps an attack on the Saudi Arabian oil fields, terrorism all over the world, and then of course the whole problem of repeated attacks on Iran and perhaps even the logic of occupying Iran. Well, something for which a draft would be necessary, not to be thought of. And I think the president has rightly seen that attacking Syria, as John McCain, Lindsey Graham, even Chuck Hagel have urged him, attacking the Syrian government, which is Iran's ally, works against that higher priority. Strategy is subordinating the lesser to the higher goal. The higher goal for this president, I believe, and I think the evidence is there, is avoid war with Iran and stop Iran from getting a bomb. And he's kept his eye on that ball. And you see in Iraq, they're both on the same side. And in Syria, he's now coming under pressure. Well, you've got to strike Assad. If he does that, he's also going to be striking Iran and perhaps endangering this paramount strategic goal of the United States.
Josh Letterman, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Iran has flatly denied working with the U.S., of course, on these airstrikes. Neither side wants to appear to be cooperating with the other. But what does this mean down the road? Another partner in this coalition?
I think partner is probably too strong a word, but you have a case here of two countries that don't see eye to eye, but in this strange circumstance happen to have interests that are very much aligned. So I think you have this dance that the U.S. and Iran are doing where the U.S. says, well, you know, we're not going to coordinate with you, but, you know, if you want to go ahead and strike the heck out of the Islamic State, you know, that's, you know, we're certainly not going to stop you. And Iran kind of the same thing. The risk, of course, is that once there's any kind of actual coordination, you have both optical problems with the U.S. Coordinating with a country that you know, the United States still accuses of funding terrorism, and also the very real concerns about, you know, if we're telling them, you know, don't strike at this location because we're going to be in there. Well, then that's kind of sharing intelligence information, and that's sharing even U.S. military information with a country that the United States military establishment still really much does not trust and does not want to be on that kind of footing with.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let's get a caller in here on this. Dennis in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. Real quick, we shared information with the Soviets to keep things from blowing up sometimes. And about the ISIS really reminds me of the Khmer Rouge. And the Khmer Rouge, numerically and any way you measure it, was much worse than ISIS. They killed so many more people, and we didn't go to war against the Khmer Rouge. And and also blaming Obama for the Khmer Rouge, like some of the people in the comments section of this show and other shows have been blaming Obama for ISIS. That's about as nonsensical as blaming Nixon for the Khmer Rouge.
All right, Dennis. Thank you. Jack Beatty, you want to respond?
That's hard to beat that analogy. I mean, of course, at the time, I have to say that there was a whole critique of the Nixon administration, that the clandestine bombing of Cambodia, which went on for months, and which was, in some senses, you know, certainly wasn't known even to the Congress or to most members of Congress, that helped to bring about to create the Khmer Rouge rebellion and give it a start. So it's more complicated there, I think, on the Nixon end.
Also out of Iraq this week, an agreement over oil revenues between the Kurdish government and the Iraqi government. Josh Letterman, what does that mean from the White House perspective for Iraq and the fight there against the Islamic State?
This is huge and one of the rare points of good news for the situation with the United States and Iraq. That means that basically the Kurds and the Iraqi government will be able to work together in combating the Islamic State without this major issue hanging over their heads. And the Kurds have really been one of the key variables in this crisis, not only in Iraq, but also in Syria, where they're also fighting the Islamic State, but are causing some problems for the U.S. effort to try and get Turkey to be more involved. So I think that the United States has looked at this as a very positive sign that two groups that we want to be on the same page in the Islamic State fight, the Iraqi government and the Kurds in Iraq, are going to be able to do that without a ton of immediate conflict. Mm.
And Jack Beatty, interestingly this week, Rand Paul introduced a declaration of war against the Islamic State in the Senate. How do you see that playing out?
Yes, and a declaration of war, he quickly said, will have no, you know, if we're not going to send boots on the ground. Congress has to vote on this. I mean, whether it's a resolution, whether it's not going to be a declaration of war, but they certainly have to give the president, or they have to debate and vote on the authority he has to conduct this campaign, the connection to the September 11th, the post-September 11th congressional resolutions, those are too tenuous to allow a president to conduct a war on his own.
But Josh, would a formal declaration of war from Congress change anything for the president, do you think?
Well, sure, it would change some things for the president. But the other thing about a formal declaration of war is that really opens a new chapter in this military conflict in the Middle East under Obama's watch. Whereas Obama had wanted to be the president to end the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq and really refocus the U.S. Engagement overseas on perhaps more positive, constructive things like the pivot to Asia, that would really be codifying a new era for U.S. military engagement in a very messy conflict in the Middle East in a way that would perhaps be damaging to his legacy and not something that a lot of the country wants to stomach at this point in time.
Jack Beatty, we're going to get to this after the break as well, but 17 states filed a lawsuit this week challenging President Obama's executive action on immigration, saying he overstepped White House authority, violated the Constitution. What did you make of these lawsuits this week?
Well, they're in parallel with perhaps even the same governors and attorneys general. They're in parallel with suits on the Affordable Care Act, and probably will have a similarly nugatory effect. You know, also the House Republicans voted a resolution yesterday, basically disapproving and saying it should be, that the president's action should be null and void. That will go nowhere. But the problem with it politically is clear in in this quotation from America's Voice, which is a pro-immigration rights group. But here's what they say. Well, today the Republicans are saying what they are for. They are for deporting those who are undocumented, full stop. That's tough politically for a party that whose future has to, they've got to do better than Mitt Romney did among Hispanic voters.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, long-awaited rain brought mudslides in California. Here's Glendora resident Ken Smith.
You'll see some houses, even with all of this work that people are doing now, you'll see mud going through people's houses here in Glendora. I would bet money on it by tomorrow morning.
More women accuse Bill Cosby of sexual assault. One filed suit and hires attorney Gloria Allred.
Justice demands accountability. And if Mr. Cosby is found liable, then he should be held accountable. If not, the public will know it.
And maybe NBC's live telling of Peter Pan needed a little more fairy dust, but its music still delighted many.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't want to go to school.
I don't want to go to school.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
And recite a silly rule.
And recite a silly rule.
You can join the conversation, listeners. What do you think about the Sony Pictures hack? Was it really North Korea? What about Ray Rice looking for a second chance? The pregnant UPS driver taking her case to the Supreme Court. I'm joined by Ron Allen of NBC News, Josh Letterman of the Associated Press, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Today at the White House, President Obama announced his nomination of Ashton Carter to be Secretary of Defense.
Today I'm pleased to announce my nominee to be our next Secretary of Defense, Mr. Ash Carter. Now, with a record of service that has spanned more than 30 years as a public servant, as an advisor, as a scholar, Ash is rightly regarded as one of our nation's foremost national security leaders.
Josh Letterman, what do we know about Ashton Carter? What's his background?
Well, Ashton Carter is a longtime Pentagon guy. He has been referred to as a technocrat. He has been in charge of the military's acquisition, largely weapons buying. But let's face it, Ash Carter was not President Obama's first choice for this job. He wasn't his second choice. He probably wasn't even his third choice. Rather, he was the guy who was left standing after the people that the president wanted to fulfill this job asked to be taken out of the running and said, I don't want the job. Please stop telling reporters that you're considering me for the job. So the fact that the president had to end up nominating Ashton Carter, as qualified as he may be, reflects some larger problems and challenges for Obama's military strategy and for the future of Pentagon leadership that are going to be difficult to overcome. One thing I want to share with your listeners, the White House had told us last night that at this ceremony at the White House this morning where they were going to be nominating Ashton Carter, that Chuck Hagel, the outgoing defense secretary, was also going to be there, as is typical. This morning we found out actually Chuck Hagel decided not to come this morning. So if I think that speaks volumes about the dynamic here as Chuck Hagel is being pushed out of the Pentagon.
Hmm. Jack Beatty, Ashton Carter, the last guy standing, as Josh just says, does that signal more continuity in administration defense policy rather than change?
It does sound that way. He's a friend of this program. He's been on it many times, notably when he was expressing great alarm about North Korea. In fact, just a decade ago, he and Bill Perry, the former defense secretary, wrote a column advocating an attack on North Korea. We'll hear about that in his confirmation hearings. I hope he addresses the findings in a recent Government Accountability Office report. This found that the total budget overruns for the current weapons systems stand at nearly $500 billion. Those are the budget overruns. John McCain has talked about the, quote, military-industrial-congressional complex, talking about pet projects unwanted by the administration, the revolving door. And he asks, over the last decade, says McCain, what I have described here has resulted in a massive windfall for industry. But for the taxpayer, and warfighter, it has been an absolute recipe for disaster. That desperately needs to be addressed. You know, Democrats keep voting for the defense budget as a symbol. We're strong. And they don't take care to see that the money is spent well, and we get these $500 billion in cost overruns for this insupportably large bureaucracy.
I want to go back for just a moment to immigration and the president's executive action there. Here's some sound from Congressman Ted Yoho, Republican of Florida, introducing the bill passed by the House this week on Thursday that declares President Obama's executive action on immigration null and void. It's largely symbolic, but Yoho says it's meant to send Obama a message.
It doesn't talk about granting amnesty. It just stops an unconstitutional action by our president. To vote no against this bill is to vote no against the Constitution.
And on the floor during debate on Thursday, House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi said that the bill is cold-hearted.
In response to this presidential action of common sense and compassion, Republicans are advancing today on this floor a radical bill of appalling callousness and cruelty.
Josh Letterman, is there precedent for the executive actions the president has announced?
Well, that's a matter of a lot of debate right now in Washington. Obama and a lot of Democrats say that there certainly is. They point to what previous presidents like Reagan have done using executive action, and like Bush even, to change things for large percentages of the population of people that were in the U.S. Illegally. Republicans, of course, say this is unprecedented, goes way farther. They're accurate that there hasn't been an executive action that affected this many millions of people before. But this is, you know, this is something that I think the White House knew when they did was going to be widely debated in terms of the legality, you know, face probable court challenges, as we're now seeing from some of these states, and these inevitable efforts by Republicans to try and roll it back.
Let's get David in here, a listener from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
Yes.
Hi, and hi to Jack. Nancy Pelosi is the one who's cold-hearted. She's throwing one of our prime Democratic constituencies under the bus. Try to imagine yourself as a low-skilled American. You have no financial security or resources of any kind. And over the last 20 years or so, you've seen your job category flooded with immigrants. If you're not unemployed, you're fearful of becoming unemployed. And if you are unemployed, you're probably not going to get rehired because a lot of the crews are now run by Spanish speakers. The midterms showed just how strongly Americans oppose amnesty. The new Republican senators all campaigned against amnesty as bad labor policy for American workers. Blue state Oregon voted 68-32% to kill legislation that would have given driver's licenses to illegal aliens. And, you know, I just don't know what's wrong with the Democratic Party these days.
David, thank you. Let me ask Jack Beatty to respond.
Well, you know, David is talking about problems in the labor market, especially at the bottom, and he's very right to be that the Democrats are in they're cross-pressured. On the one hand, they say we're the party of the American working people, and on the other hand, they seem to want to give them low-wage competition. The argument that proponents for reform make is, wait a minute. If these people can come out of the shadows, they have to be paid according to the minimum wage. Once someone comes forward and makes that declaration, and that's going to be a very risky thing for many people, they have the same protections under labor law as American workers. They do not have those now. And now you've got competition for people who will, you know, take less than the minimum wage for odious jobs. And you know, it's not for nothing that organized labor is for the comprehensive immigration reform, precisely for reasons like this, that it would even the playing field by bringing undocumented workers up, not by pulling American workers down.
Let's go to the Supreme Court, where this week it's considered whether businesses must accommodate pregnant employees. The case was brought by Peggy Young, a woman who had been driving for UPS for about 4 years and then became pregnant. When UPS put her on unpaid leave because her doctor advised her she shouldn't lift anything more than 20 pounds, she sued. Young spoke with NPR's Morning Edition. Here's that.
It was financially difficult for us to have to deal with me not getting my pay every week. A lot of times I didn't sleep so well. It was very disturbing some that you couldn't work when you wanted to work. They coded me in their system as disability, but I didn't qualify for disability because I could work. I'm a normal person. I was just pregnant.
Josh Letterman, the potential here to affect the lives of millions of pregnant women in the workforce, pretty significant.
Very significant. You're right. It does have the ability to affect a lot of people, and you know, has sort of become a way to discuss you know, broader issues of, you know, what kind of accommodations we should have for pregnant workers and for other people that might have disabilities that might entitle them to some type of accommodation within the confines of their workforce. So I think that women's groups, but also advocacy groups for a lot of other populations in the country are very closely watching this.
Here's Aaron in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Aaron. Glad you waited. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. There's another case before the Supreme Court right now regarding a man who made threats against his wife on Facebook.
Yes.
He was told to stop, then made the threats against public grade schools, then made a threat against an FBI agent. He finally got arrested after harassing his wife for months, and his case is actually before the Supreme Court now. I simply don't understand why the court took this case. I mean, I realize they're examining free speech rights and comparing his screeds to rap music, but there's another case out of Washington State this week where a black man was arrested for supposedly making threats against Darren Wilson. If the court allows the first guy to make his threats, then why don't they have to let the Washington man go also? I feel that this is sort of related to the issue of police violence and that it speaks to the whole current zeitgeist of the powerless losing their rights and freedoms. In a Facebook case, a woman continues to get threatened and no one cares for a long, long time. If the court allows that, people everywhere will have to suffer bullying and violence all over the place.
Aaron, thank you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Jack Beatty, speak to that caller Aaron and the important case, another one, the Facebook case before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and on its face, this Facebook case really does seem absurd. You know, unlike rap lyrics, which are, you know, offensive to any sensibility, it seems to me, but those are generalized. That's, you know, about what all hoes, aka women. But it's not specified. It's not about a particular person. This is, and I don't see how that can be, you know, cabined under any idea of free speech. You can't go around threatening people.
Here's Dave in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Dave. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hey, hi, Jane.
Hi.
I speaking a little bit to another topic. I heard you speak about the Cosby issue, and
okay.
When I see these stories, I followed it quite closely. When I see the stories and the responses to the story, I see a similar pattern. It seems in this current cultural climate, political climate, that a claim of or an allegation of rape, no matter how difficult it may be to believe, the veracity of it can never be question because it's a claim of rape. Even if the story is to the point of almost laughability, some of the stories that we've seen accusing Cosby are almost ludicrous in their proponents, but still it's a claim of rape, and so it must be taken, I guess, with a heavy head, or it must be considered legitimately. And I find that kind of troubling, and that someone once told me the hardest thing to defend is something that never happened. And with these claims being 40, 50 years old, it's almost impossible. I mean, what will they do to discover evidence? What will they do to examine the veracity of these claims?
All right, Dave. Because of time, I'm just going to ask Josh Letterman, or maybe Ron Allen, jump back in here, NBC News. Attorney Gloria Allred demanded Cosby meet his accusers in court or set aside $100 million to settle their claims. These are decades-old cases. What do you say?
Yeah, but I think they're going to be taken very seriously because think of the power arrangement between Mr. Cosby and these accusers. And, you know, I don't think that anybody is dismissive of these women at all. I just don't think that's the way these things are being looked at. And it's just tragic and sad for Bill Cosby, for these women. But again, and there will be evidence. It'll be a lot of he said, she said. But I think these cases have to be taken very seriously. And it's a terrible thing for Mr. Cosby's legacy. But if he's guilty of these things, he needs to be accountable. And these women, think of what it took for them to come forward to take on this very powerful individual. They've been, if these allegations are true, they've been living with these things for years and years and years, decades. And just a tragedy all the way around.
Let's quickly, before the time's out here, go to Sony Pictures in Hollywood. It reads like a blockbuster screenplay, Jack Beatty. Hackers infiltrating corporate email, disabling internal computer systems, leaking 5 films, a slew of sensitive personal data. The work of North Korea, apparently, in retaliation for Sony's upcoming movie, a comedy about a CIA plot to kill Kim Jong-un.
Yes, whoever knew that, whoever could have guessed that a Seth Rogen comedy would have these international repercussions, but there it is.
Yeah.
And it shows the paranoid state of that hermit kingdom, doesn't it? And as somebody pointed out, it also shows they have simply no conception of what entertainment is as opposed to what propaganda is. But I'm amazed, frankly, at their technological capability to be able to do this. We keep hearing about how backward and primitive and all the rest. Well, my gosh, there's this plus their nuclear exertions. It's a frightening picture.
Ron Allen, quite a development at the intersection of international relations, commerce, and cyberspace.
It is. North Korea is such an unusual place. I remember going there many, many years ago and just being struck by how primitive and how lost in time this place is. But it'll be interesting to see what happens there, because it's not going to be a hermit kingdom forever. And one of these days it will open up and reveal a lot of things that I think will be striking to many of us.
Many thanks to great guests today. Ron Allen, news correspondent for NBC News. Great speaking with you, Ron. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Josh Letterman, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Josh, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
And On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Thanks as always, Jack.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, ISIS is the richest terrorist organization ever. We'll look at their business model and how to disrupt it. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a good weekend, everyone. This is On Point.